And can you still hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. One last thing I like to always mention to folks before I interview them. If you ever come across something that you want to be off the record, please let me know before you say it, if you can. Okay. Yes, thank you. Okay. First, if you don't mind, Casey, can you go into a little bit of background for folks who aren't super familiar with Unite Oregon about the work that your organization does with people of color, low-income Oregonians, and refugees and immigrants?
Yes, so Unite Oregon is a social, racial, economic justice organization. We've been around, if you add the years between the two organizations, we merged with Center for Cultural Organizing and Oregon Action. We have about history of close to 50 years of community organizing and racial justice and immigrant refugee rights. Currently, we have three offices. One, the main office is in Portland, and we have an office in Washington County, and we have an office in Rogue Valley, Medford, Oregon. Those are the three offices. And we have a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial, multilingual staff members who are actually doing the work. And our mission is really to unite urban and rural community for economic and racial justice. That's what we do, and we have quite a few programs that really works with the people of color, immigrant refugees, and low income. And one of the programs I usually highlight is about our leadership development program, which really trains emerging immigrant refugee leaders to a year-long program in Portland that helps to gain skills necessary to push their community issues forward. And Rogue Valley, we work with the youth and we work with the trained other emerging leaders to get the work, get involved the organizations and do the work that is necessary to be done. So that's kind of in general, overall what we do. But most important takeaway point is that we are a grassroots organization, and we want our community members who are aligned with our values and our mission to get involved in the organization. So staff is facilitators, they're organizers, but the most important thing we would like to see happen is that the community members take action and get involved in the organization's day-to-day activities and programs.
That's great. And as a grassroots organization that works so closely with the community and specifically with people of color, immigrants, refugees, and low-income Oregonians, as you just stated, in so many different ways, can you talk about why it's that important for Unite Oregon to, as you've made it public, to ask for City Council to defund the Portland Police Bureau?
I think this is really a question that's very complex, and so I will start with, first of all, the history of United States policing and where we have the police history, police departments across the country that's historically connected to the slavery and white supremacy. So that's really the history. And then, of course, you know, throughout the years and decades of our policing and targeting people of color, immigrant refugees, and low-income communities to repressive tactics and killings. And it has been really, really profoundly impacted in the community that we work with. And secondly, it's the structures that we have, right? So we have police departments that really historically are not accountable to anyone, including, I will say, the elected officials, who has power that is unchallenged. They are able to kill people, detain people, tear gas protesters, and there's no accountability. There's no one accountable. They are above the law. And so that's another issue. And then generally then, you know, community organizations like ours have been decades advocating for change and asking the police department to be reformed, to be held accountable. And it went to a deep ears. So what you have right now is the perfect storm where, you know, community has been really been impacted by the police brutality and police targeting their community, especially the low-income and people of color, and particularly the Black community. So the combination of those, the structural issues, the lack of accountability, and then, of course, their share of the budget that they take out from the programs they did from the city, which is, for the past decades, the police department, the police bureau's budget really dramatically decreased. We spend the police department more than we spend in our housing and homelessness issues. We spend actually more than 7 times amount of money that we spend on housing. We spend more money than parks and recreation. We spend more money on the fire department and fire department. Those are really critical services, and homelessness and housing issues. Those are critical services that if we take the money and put it into those services, can help the community and really elevate some of the painful historically unjust that we have done to our communities, particularly Black and Brown community. So those are some of the larger contexts that why we ask the funding the police of an amount of $50 million. This is the beginning, and I actually want to emphasize this is actually a very, very small amount compared to the resources that they're already getting. So we're not actually, as I said, this is the beginning. This is not all we're asking. We want a systemic change. We want a policy change. We want to be held accountable to our police departments and our law enforcement folks. So this is not a big ask, actually, as I said. So I will really stop there and see if you have additional questions. But overall, what we're asking is that we wanted this resource to go to the programs that serve the community that we has been historically impacted, particularly the Black and Brown community. So that's kind of really where we're standing for. And I think, again, the moment is right, and I think we're asking the leadership of the city and the mayor and the commissioners to meet the demands of the community that ask this small change that we're asking.
Thank you for explaining that. And you're saying how you want a positive change. You explained, thank you for explaining briefly as you could about the history of police in America and how that's impacted the Portland community, specifically communities of color. And you mentioned how $50 million in the grand scheme of things is a small portion of at least $1 billion general funds pool of money. And you spoke about the different ways this money could be used instead of being given to the police. Can you go into how reinvesting that money into the community, specifically community members that have been largely ignored since Portland's founding? Can you talk about why that's so important?
I think it's important, first of all, because as I said, earlier, majority of the calls of the police calls that the 911 dispatchers receive and police respond to is non-criminal related activity, meaning that there is no criminal activity going on. What it really is about livability issues. Someone calling for a houseless person for the police and for someone who has a mental health crisis. Those are basics of most of the calls that they receive. That is a waste of time, resources, and energy. Those police officers generally tend to escalate the situation and arrest or detain folks who are houseless. As Oregonian reported, 52% of the arrests that has been made last year was made by were the homeless and houseless community. These folks are not trained to de-escalate. They're not trained to be social workers. They're not trained to be kind and humane to people who are struggling. They are trained to oppress and really escalate the situations that they're dealing with. So what we're asking is that this money to be reallocated and reinvest the community so we can provide rental assistance, we can provide mental health programs, we can provide youth leadership development programs, we can provide potentially, mortgage assistance, particularly the Black and Brown community which has been impacted. We can provide economic investment support, particularly the small businesses that are owned by Black and Brown community. So we are not short of ideas. There's so many ways that we can invest this money. And PALF and UN organizations actually asking that, that there's a special money to be set aside, and those money should be decided by the community who have been impacted, how to invest back to the community. Andrew, do you want to add anything?
I would just say that I would recommend folks take a look at PALF's People's Plan that was developed several years ago, because it's got a number of really strong, actionable recommendations to lift up the health and well-being, particularly of Black Portlanders. And it calls for things like, you know, investing funding in culturally specific mental health care healing centers, right, that can really meet folks' needs in a community-centered context. Using funding to improve neighborhood access to healthy food and safe recreation, right? A really broad agenda for health and well-being, and that's really what we're calling for, right? Reinvesting this money that we have spent on over-policing and policing in general, right? Because I think we take this the stance that we are working towards the abolition of police, really wanting to invest that funding in things that matter, like the health and well-being of partners who have been targeted by police violence.
And Andrew, you mentioned the word abolition of police. For many folks who are listening, whether they are in support of this mission or in opposition, they're going to hang on to that word, I believe. Is the ultimate goal to disband the Portland Police Bureau, as other cities are calling for throughout the nation?
That's a great question, and what I would say is that that is the goal that we have identified with PALF and Unite, right? And as Casey said, this $50 million demand is really the start. That is our demand for this current budget cycle. I think as organizations, we don't think that, you know, it's just a matter of passing an ordinance to abolish the Portland Police Bureau, right? That we need to do some really intentional work in the community to lift up community safety, to really have the community develop a vision for how we can keep ourselves safe in a world without police. But I do think that that's the world that we are envisioning and imagining, and that's what we're working towards.
So let me add to that. The question of abolition of the police, it's for me as a former refugee, it's a very complex one. And what I would like to say is that, you know, if we need to have something in place to get there. In my understanding of my country, where I come from, you know, when we have the institution systems being dismantled, or because of the civil war, we have to create some sort of a response to how safety and the community has been taken care of. It. So my suggestion is that, you know, this is a long-term goal, but we want to have to also envision a place where, you know, our community is safe and harmonious, and we're able to create a system that's more accountable to the community that they serve. So that's kind of really, for me, the nuance that I want to add to the complexity of the issue. But at the end of the day, I do believe that Portland Police, and in general, it's not a formidable entity. So I think at some point that we have to really decide what kind of a safety mechanism that we want to have in place, and what kind of a law enforcement force that we're going to have, if we have, we want to have, and what even that means, what it looks like. I wouldn't even call the law enforcement, but I think if we have we're going to create a peace agent that is more responsible to the support and the well-being of the community, we have to envision as a community what that's going to look like. So that's kind of the complexity of the issue.
Thank you for explaining that and taking the time to do so, both of you. I want to get into two things. But before I get into what you just mentioned about how you believe the Portland Police Bureau is not reformable, I'd like you to first, if you can, explain how you envision a different society in Portland that doesn't largely rely on the police to do, as you mentioned earlier, to deal with issues of the homeless community, whether that's health-related, mental health issues, or when, as we know, the sweeps happen. Can you talk about what a different Portland community would look like without relying so heavily on the police department for so many different things?
So I think for me, the first of all, we have to look into the structures of the society, right? So I think a few minutes, I'm going to take a little bit more about kind of explaining where we are as a society. Right now, our society is extremely, as you know, is divided in terms of the economic disparities and racial and ethnic disparities. If you really want to have a healthy, well-structured society, you have to also address the systematic and the cultural white supremacy that we have in this country. Without that touching the people's mindset, how safety and community cohesion should evolve, it boils down to really dismantling white supremacy in this country, and then dismantling the structural economic systems that really doesn't serve and support the well-being of majority of the society. So there has to be societal change that needs to happen in order to create a space where we can envision a just and harmonious community society that really takes care of each other and supports each other. Without that really transformative societal change, I think we're going to have a long history of continuously of injustices that we are seeing. So that's the first place. But, you know, are we going to see this in my lifetime or your lifetime? I honestly don't know. This is a really complex issue. But we have to envision and dream about that kind of a vision, a long-term vision. And only the way that it can happen is that when we build a movement that is really based in the community that they are in, that really can create the change and systematic change that necessary to take place in order to get where we need to be getting our society. So it's a very difficult and complex answer, but again, they're all entwined. So what I'm fearful for me is like, you know, that if we have a white supremacist movement in this country and this state and this community, if they are as they did in the last year and this year, and they still support them, and they are armed and well armed as a black man, you know, where's my safety comes up? You know, who am I relying to my safety? If these folks of the militia who are unaccountable to anybody, who can kill anybody if they decide, where's my safety and who am I going to keep me safe? So until that, really, those are the questions that as a black African refugee man, I have to struggle and have to think about my safety as a person. And that's really individual place, but societal place, those are the context and the new ones that we have to think about. And I want to invite Andrew to be able to add. So I'm sorry it took me a long time to explain, but that's
how. Yes.
Yeah.
Andrew, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, to answer that question, I would start thinking about all of the different ways that we can empower police to deal with, I even hesitate to call them social problems, right? But let's, you know, for lack of a better phrase, right? We have school resource officers, and the idea there is apparently if, you know, a student is having challenges in school, apparently you need an armed police officer there, right? That seems wrong to me. In that same way, right, you know, what students are going to need is counseling. They're going to need trauma-informed care. They're going to need folks who can really invest in their education and their future. And you can't do that as well if you are paying for police officers. And I actually just learned a quite shocking thing the other day, which is that the Peterson School District, for example, has school resource police officers in many of its schools, from elementary on up. Very few of the schools have nurses. That to me is backwards, right? We are ceding different things to the police that we should. And it's the same as Casey mentioned with the treatment of our unhoused community, right? The solution is as much as, you know, I hate to talk about a solution, right? But the challenge is that there's, you know, not enough housing that's been made available to folks who can't afford it, right? I'm not going to say that there's not enough housing because there's a lot of vacant housing in Portland. But the solution to, you know, any challenges related to houselessness are building housing, giving folks a place to live, giving them the ability to thrive with as few barriers as possible. But instead, we've turned that over to police, to sweep camps, to destroy people's property, to destroy people's communities that they have eked out of a really brutal system. And I think that those are just a couple of examples of where we have really turned to police. We've turned to this very violent, very carceral model that ultimately does result in people being placed in prison, locked in cages, to address issues that have absolutely nothing to do with the presence of our paramilitaries, right? We're addressing so many different issues through police, and we need to stop that. And so my vision for the world to come involves that. It involves really addressing, as Casey said, the root causes of any issues that we are seeing in the community, right? If there are folks who don't have housing, we give them housing. If there are folks who are struggling with crisis in their mental or emotional health, we make sure that they have supportive services that are available to them and meet them where they're at, right? Culturally competent services and what have you. We don't invest that money, or we shouldn't invest that money, in armed paramilitaries who, as we see, ultimately just target folks for arrest, citation, and imprisonment, and in some cases, maim and murder us.
Real quick, just playing devil's advocate for those who I know will want to ask this question. How do you keep those other organizations that would take on the responsibility that police are currently doing, and some might argue, many might argue, are failing at? How do you keep those entities accountable and not doing the same harm, just under a different name, than the police?
That's a really good question. And this is an opportunity for me to be really clear that the vision that I have for policing moving forward is not give all of police powers to another slightly friendlier agency that looks and acts very much the same, right? I don't think the solution, as Casey said, is reform to make police somehow slightly less violent, if that were possible. But what I would say is that that's a huge question that I think we dig into a lot around school districts, cities, counties, metro, TriMet, other agencies. And I think, you know, this is connected to what Casey is saying around the need to transform society in ways that promote community safety, in ways that, move beyond policing. And to me, it involves smaller scale communities to which, folks are accountable. I think that that's one of the most important things for promoting safety, is making sure that communities are accountable to one another. And in school districts, I think, or cities or counties or what have you, there's a lot of different things we're going to need to look at to honestly improve direct democracy in Portland, improve the accountability of folks to the grassroots, and improve the accountability each of us have to one another as Portlanders.
Thank you for explaining that, and I appreciate you answering the question. I know it's very complex and it's much further down the road. Can you explain, either Andrew or Casey, the word reformable is used earlier, in that Casey, I believe you said that you don't believe that the Portland Police Bureau is capable of being reformable. Can either or both of you get into why you believe that, and why we can't just in some ways fix the police, whether it involves funding or not funding them?
I want to quickly jump and then I'll invite Andrew. So first of all, there is a history, right? So the community that we work with, and particular organizations who are focused on criminal justice reform and police reform, decades and decades and decades have been asking demands to the police bureau be held accountable and be transformed to a more accountable agency. What we have seen is that they've resisted, and elected officials who are supposed to be in control and the law enforcement and our police department has resisted any meaningful change. And to the contrary, we have seen more and more police militarized police department where, they actually became even more military force rather than a police force. Although we were demanding change, and we've seen the problem for decades, instead of change and accountability, really became more and more going to the opposite direction. And not only that, they forcefully rejected any call to even have a basic, meaningful accountability discussions. And then the second piece is that what we said, I do believe historically the agency is really rooted in the white supremacy model. So you just can't have that. If your basic infrastructure, if you live in a house and your foundation is not solid, and it's not able to uphold the house that you're living in, that house is going to collapse and it's not going to be a livable place. What we have the Portland Police Bureau is an organization that is structurally fundamentally important, and so we, you know, as I said earlier, we demanded change for many years, and again it really went in the opposite direction rather than being accountable. And they also envisioned, finally, as I said earlier, they also forcefully go against any change that's hold them accountable. So those are some of the basic elements that I'm raising when I say that I do believe that Portland Police is not formable. Those are some of the ingredients that makes difficult to do any meaningful reform.
Thank you. Andrew, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I'll just add quickly. I think I just want to echo Casey there that you can only reform a system if the foundation is solid. And as Casey, you know, explained earlier, the foundation of all policing in America is rooted in slavery, is rooted in racism, is rooted in white supremacy, and you fundamentally cannot divorce that from policing. And then when we look at Portland, we have to acknowledge that reforms have been tried for decades and decades and decades. Organizers that I'm working with have been banging their head against the wall for longer than I've been alive, trying to fight for justice in Portland, and it's not working. And you know that because we can list off the names of people from our community who have been killed by Portland police, right? Aaron Campbell, Deontay Keller, Keaton Otis, Patrick Timmons, Andre Gladen, James Jahar Perez, Kendra James, and so many more. They are not with us because reform doesn't work, right? And after every one of those very public deaths, after every one of those very public police murders, there is a wave of reform, a wave of good energy, and then we return to business as usual. And so I think in practice, the failure of any of those reforms to meaningfully hold Portland police accountable, combined with the fact that policing is racist at its core, means that you just cannot reform the Portland police.
Thank you for explaining that. And playing devil's advocate, no one can ignore exactly what you just said, that there are still going to be folks who will say, we can't completely remove the police because of issues of murder and serious egregious cases, like murder and rape and other types of violent acts. Can you talk to those folks? What would you say to those folks who fear completely removing the police force?
I think for me, let me be very clear. We do want to have a community safety plan. No one is saying that, you know, as I started earlier, we're not saying that completely we will have, you know, in many ways, what you can call libertarian world where everybody is living in their own way and being responsible on their safety. There has to be some social contract mechanism that we have to build in for community safety plan. Personally, as someone who came from a war-torn country, I do believe that there has to be some sort of a safety mechanism. But I think in order to get there, that kind of a way where we talk about creating systems that's different than what we have right now, the ingredients, again, has to be there. So I want to invite those folks really to think about it strategically, to be visionaries and really, first of all, agree with us that the fundamental societal contract has to change, and we have to create economic systems change in this country. We have to create social and societal norms where, you know, we have to figure out how we treat each other, how we deal with each other individually. And we have to elevate some of the baneful historical wrongs that has been done to Black and brown communities. Those are some of the ingredients that has to be in place before we think about whether we want to have what kind of a law enforcement, what kind of a, you know, system that we're going to replace what we have right now. What we know of is that what we have right now, it's not working and it's not going to work. But again, in order to get what different systems, we have to be able to also create the mechanism and the space and to have that deeper discussion and have the ingredients in place, both economic justice, racial justice and overall societal interconnectedness.
So to be clear and to clarify, there has to be space for a new way of doing things rather than just trying to push for a better, more idealistic society.
I'm not personally, I'm not advocating for libertarian space. I'm not. Like, I don't want to like it. So we are interconnected society. We are interconnected community. We are a community that really has to have some sort of a social contract. And so in order to do that, we need to have some sort of a system in place to make sure that the safety of the most vulnerable populations have been taken care of. What that system looks like is completely has to be different than what we have. But what that system looks like, we're not even there yet even to have to envision that. We have to really think about what I said earlier, what's the ingredients to even have that kind of a conversation and visioning process.
Gotcha. Thank you for clarifying that. Going back to defunding, and we can wrap up here with the Portland Police Bureau, there's going to be the city council meeting today that Mayor Wheeler should be able to hopefully attend today. He has made claims, or rather promises, that he will remove the gun violence reduction team as well as the transit division. Can you talk about whether or not that's a, because that is mentioned in Unite Oregon's and PALF's letter calling for defunding the Portland Police Bureau. Can you talk about whether or not that's a step in the right direction? Is that enough? Where do we go from here if that happens?
Yeah, what I would say is that yes, it is a step in the right direction, but no, it is not enough. And I think that that's something we're going to focus on as an organization, right? If what happens today is just a cut to the school resource officer program, gun violence reduction team, and a change in how the transit police operate, that is, certainly making progress, but it's not nearly big enough, not nearly fast enough. And especially because I do want to make folks aware that the plan for the transit police is actually to transition them to the command of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. So it's not like the transit police will be going away, nor will it be that, you know, seemingly Portland police will not participate in it. It's just changing the command structure a little bit, right? And that, to me, is very much not good enough, right? We need to get police off of buses and trains. But what I would say is we're in this for the long haul, right? We are going to keep fighting, and we're going to keep working with grassroots Portlanders to push this. And I think you've seen that over the last 2 weeks where probably hundreds of thousands of Portlanders collectively have come out to the streets. Hundreds testified yesterday at City Council loudly saying defund the police, $50 million now, and those special units that you mentioned. And at the last time I counted, it was something like 60 to 65,000 emails to City Council in the last week. So I think that there's clearly grassroots energy towards this. I think we're going to keep fighting, and we're going to keep fighting until we win. And for me, I'm a little old-fashioned in my organizing. I believe you make a demand on power, and you keep fighting until you win that demand. Even if you make some compromises along the way, you don't consider those a victory until you've gotten what you originally wanted.
So this is what I want to add to what Andrew said. So let's step back. I think what they are offering is really very, very minimum incremental changes. I think Portland has historically done any time that we have issues challenging like this, they tend to try to wiggle out by really trying to create a more meaningful, small incremental changes, and then sit back and say, oh, look, we solved the problem. We created, this should be celebrated as a big victory, and we all wash our hands and go this business as usual. What right now we have is that we have a movement who is organized by youth and led by youth, and I want to thank each and every one of them, those organizers who are on the ground, who are really leading and every night organizing. So this is a different era. What the elected official is right now not understanding is that yesterday is not today. We have a movement that's really committed until the meaningful change take place. They're not going to go away. So I would say that the lots of officials are really behind. They assume that what they did in the past, as I said earlier, business as usual, wiggle around the issues, do a few things here and there, and then assume, call it a good and say, okay, we all did what we're supposed to do, and we celebrate that. What they are offering and the 19 points that the mayor released is absolutely not good enough. what we're asking is that $50 million investment from Portland Police, and then on top of that, we're asking meaningful systematic change that can lead in the right direction and create some sort of different community policing that we should have in this city. So I would just say that absolutely not, and I would encourage people who are listening to keep the pressure up. If they do not meet our demands, then hopefully we can meet at the ballot box. That's really where people can force also their anger and frustration. People are angry, are frustrated, and they are demanding change, and what they are offering is absolutely not acceptable.
And it definitely, the pressure's on. As Andrew said, I read recently on Joanne Hardesty's Facebook page that Hardesty received at least 61,000 emails in response to this call for, I believe, specifically defunding the police, but also just in general, the protests, anger towards the police. So with this widespread, what seems like support, do you see that support growing? And how can this be potentially a model for the entire nation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what I would say is the thing that's really inspiring to me is that the grassroots energy in the streets is not about one vote on the budget. Honestly, it's just kind of fortuitous that the city of Portland is debating its budget right now. But the demand is not connected to some opaque parliamentary procedure at city council. It is a grassroots demand. As Casey said, you know, the folks out in the streets have been showing their passion, showing their anger, showing their militant joy. And that's where those demands are coming from. And I think it's going to keep growing, right? And I think that's especially true if we do not see major meaningful cuts today to the Portland Police Bureau. I can't imagine those 61,000 people who have written in, the hundreds of thousands in the street, the hundreds of city council are going to accept that. And I think that that's really inspiring for me to see the number of people who are saying, no, we need to be bigger, we need to be bolder, we need to be faster. And I think that's going to continue until we win, frankly.
Oh, sorry. Was that the end? Hello?
Yep.
Oh, sorry. Casey, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that?
No, I think that Andrew covered. I think that what we really need to see is that this is not only Portland movement. Everyone knows that this is really become historic movement across the country. Even the small towns that I have never thought that they will have some sort of a Black Lives Matter rallies, and holding rallies, and so people are across the country, across the cities, and across the states, are really angry and frustrated how the police, law enforcement folks have the immunity for any wrongdoing. And on top of that, brutalizing and for people of color, immigrant refugees, and low-income community. So this is a nationwide movement. This is not going to stop it until we really have the meaningful change that we are demanding. So I think the city council and the leadership we have in the city, I hope they will take a note, because many of the other cities across the states are actually offering some of them as meaningful as change. You know, as you heard about the Los Angeles, LA, although it's a bigger city, is recommending reducing their police budget from $150 million. Mm-hmm. Seattle right now is considering 50% reduction of their police budget. So there is actually, people are finally paying attention to what's really happening in this country. And I want to hold accountable for our elected officials and our police departments across the country. So this is not something unique to Oregon and Portland. We are seeing national movement, and I think we will see some meaningful changes that will need to happen. And I think what I'm asking is that the community who are listening, that individual, we all have the power, whether it's through the ballot box, that where you can vote at people who are aligned with your values, or whether you can ask them to demand, as you've been doing, emailing and calling for the city council and the mayor to be accountable to the communities that they serve. So let's keep the pressure, let's move forward, and I think we're gonna get there.
Thank you. I wanna be respectful of both of your time. Is there anything I didn't ask that you would like to include in this conversation?
Nope, not for me.
Okay.
I think not for me too.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and turn off the recorder. One second.